Staff gave me that. Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor, Wednesday, March 18th. A couple public hearings and two work sessions today. With that, would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3058. Jan, can you give us a brief description?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure permits a retired member of PERS to work for the school district or the ESD as a teacher of career and technical education for an unlimited number of hours without any loss of retirement benefits. And it provides that the retiree is to remain in the same bargaining unit that they had been in before they retired. It sunsets June 30th, 2018, declares an emergency, and no amendments.
Thank you. Representative Comp, would you like to kick us off with this bill this morning?
Sure.
Dun, dun, dun.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Comp. I represent House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and I really want to appreciate and thank you for holding a hearing on House Bill 3058. And Jan gave my whole testimony, so I'm here to answer questions.
She's a very good administrator.
Thank you.
Well, she really is.
I appreciate the compliment.
This bill is literally to add an exception to the rule for teachers, an exception so that a teacher that has been formally certified and has certification for the CTE teacher, and that probably comes under a big umbrella of definitions and can be done in rulemaking for any of the other parts of this. This bill literally is to provide the opportunity for school districts to hire retired folks, because a number of years ago, OSU was the university to go if you wanted to teach shop, metals, welding, technology, and their program closed a number of years ago. And so as we are gearing up with our technology programs and creating workers for Oregonians, these teachers need to be able to have the opportunity to teach a little longer. And I appreciate your consideration, and yes, I'm open to questions, and I do have some other people here that can answer any technical things, too, that are going to be testifying.
Great. Questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Did you put a sunset on the bill?
There is a sunset on the bill. I'm not... LC put the sunset on the bill. I didn't. I'm not too fond of some sunsets, but yes, there is a sunset on the bill.
Just a comment, but you know, we seem to have a number of these kinds of bills coming, and the point is that there is a shortage. On the other hand, at some point there shouldn't be, and I think it's bad policy to keep going.
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Kinnemer and committee, your point is well taken, because part of what we want to do is we have some key people here in our state that are going to, we hope to, that they're going to become trainers, and you're exactly right, that our goal is to have approximately 600 teachers certified within a couple of years, and you're right, then we would not necessarily need this exception.
Representative Doherty.
And Representative Comp, I think on the same lines as, I mean, I came out of North Clackamas, which has a skills center, and we had a lot of teachers that were not college graduate teachers. They were out of the trades. They were plumbers and steam fitters and sheet metal people and so on that were excellent teachers, and I know that they had vocational certificates. So hopefully all of the STEM stuff will also include some of the vocational folks that we have coming out of apprentice programs that will also be able to treat teach other things other than something that requires a college degree.
Right. So. Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, the people that are following me are going to share some of those exact thoughts.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Great.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, in following up on that, I'm wondering if those educators that are those in the field that would come in and have that opportunity to teach, if the retired teacher coming back in would trump their opportunity.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I do not know that answer, and Vicki Chamberlain is here, and she might know that response, but in a school.
She's saying no.
There's a fellow that was shaking his head back there, though, so yeah. Perhaps he
both
knows.
Both said no. Well,
no, one of them said, yeah, that's right.
I'll tell you what, Representative Comp, we will nail them down on this question. And go ahead and excuse you to get on with your day.
Yes, well, what I would say is every school district in this state, we believe in local control. Every school district has their own negotiated contract, and that could vary from one district to another, would be my response on that. And that's just my background of being a principal talking, so.
That's probably the best answer we got. So thank you so much this morning.
You
have a good day.
Yes, I'm going to go talk about the budget.
Yes.
Well, okay. Try to have a good day.
So up next we have Don Domes, Domes, Terrell Smith, and Vicki was not on the list.
She's if you have questions.
And Mr. Chair, these two are troublemakers, so
yes,
you might have to crack the whip.
All right. We'll keep them moving.
About you, Betty.
We don't like troublemakers in this committee.
What strikes against us at this point in time?
Good morning. If you just introduce yourself for the record before you start.
Yes. Chair Holby and committee, my name is Terrell Smith. I'm a longtime computer science teacher in Sherwood School District. I have been teaching in that district for 36 years. And I also represent Oregon Computer Science Teachers Association as a leader, and Don Domes is also a leader in that organization. So we bring some perspectives from the trenches, if you will, to this the concept of Bill 3058. And so we may have some answers to the previous questions that Betty bailed on, but we were concerned as Computer Science Teacher Associations of the current status of the computer science and engineering programs in the state of Oregon. We knew we were a long-time organization, but in 2012 and 2013, we did a study to determine how many schools actually provided high-tech education. And of the 341 diploma-granting high schools in Oregon, only 49 had at least one class of engineering and/or coding. So it turns out that there's one in seven schools in Oregon, high schools in Oregon, that actually provide a high-tech education in those two areas, possibly a little more when you include engineering. Well, that's a concern to us because, as you all know from our employment issues, we need high-tech workers, and we're not getting them from, we're not giving our students opportunities at the high school level. It is said that 109,000 new STEM jobs will be available in Oregon in 5 years. 70% of those will be in the high-tech sector, and whereas we're not providing those opportunities for our students if we're only one in seven schools. It is also said that we don't have an unemployment problem in Oregon, maybe the United States, but we have a skills problem where there are three applicants for every job opening in Oregon and probably nationwide. There are three jobs available for every high-tech worker. A friend of mine tried to hire a recent graduate out of OSU at $95,000 plus benefits, and that individual turned the job down because they got a better offer. So we do find salary and job opportunities available to our citizens, but we're not training them at the high school level. So that said, we need a multiple pronged effort to get more staffing for the current programs that we're, even the current programs we have, Plus, we as an organization hope to implement, even if we get up two of seven programs in the high schools, it's going to require a lot of staff to handle the high-tech education as well as the CTE programs that will be implemented over time. And those efforts include encouraging pre-service candidates in our university college systems to add skills and credentials, maybe to snag those workers from, as was indicated earlier, from the business and industrial sector to move into teaching, to train current service teachers to take on the CTE teaching. Maybe just in general, creating more interest in CTE than ultimately the cream will rise to the top and we'll have more teachers available in the future. But as this bill suggests, House Bill 3058, that it is we're maybe retain those teachers that are already in the business with the incentives indicated by the bill. Thank you.
And my name is Don Domes. I have over 35 years of experience in teaching CTE and STEM subjects. I also have over 25 years of experience as a licensed tax consultant and small business consultant. I'm here in support of House Bill 3058. The legislature has very wisely infused millions of dollars into career technical education, CTE revitalization grants over the past two sessions. I'm very excited about that progress to date and about potential future CTE opportunities for our students. Part of why CTE is so effective is because of the actual work experience that instructors have from beyond the field of education. The work experiences from beyond the four walls of the classroom help CTE teachers reach students that may not connect with more traditional classes. But I'm very concerned about the short supply of highly skilled and highly qualified CTE teachers and substitutes. In the West Metro area of Portland, there are only two CTE-endorsed subs for technology and engineering on the sub list, and one of those is no longer subbing. Aloha High School last year had a half-time Woods instructor job that went unfilled the entire school year because they could not find a teacher. Brown Middle School has a shop that could reopen if sufficient funding and a teacher could be found. Research indicates that over half of the tech ed teachers for manufacturing and engineering classes in the Portland metro area are either age 60 or already have 25 years of teaching experience. I spoke this fall to a community member from southwestern Oregon who had helped organize thousands of dollars of tool donations to a school that ultimately closed their industrial arts program because they could not find a qualified instructor after the qualified instructor that was there retired. About a month ago, I was talking to a machine shop owner, and he told me that if someone offered him a $1 million contract to build parts, he would have to turn it down because he cannot find enough trained operators to hire. Representatives of the metals industry in Washington County asked me to meet with them last spring. I shared with them that in the third and fourth largest school districts in Oregon, which are located in Oregon, in Washington County, there's nine high schools. Out of the nine high schools, there's only 1.5 metal shops still engaging students in classes. While working on some research for the industrial and engineering pathway in Washington County, I found that we graduate about 7,000 seniors a year. That means, that in 10 years, we would graduate 70,000 students. I then asked, what will there be in terms of job projections over the next 10 years in the industrial and engineering pathway? We can't verify exactly what that'll be, but it looks like, based on our research, that we're potentially at 35,000 jobs. That means that one out of every two students could get a job in the industrial engineering pathway if they had an opportunity to train and learn about that area. Right now, we don't have enough CTE teachers in that pathway to give students even 2 years out of the 4 years of an experience at the high school level. I had a large school district ask me if they wanted to add four CTE teachers, if I would be able to find them. And I honestly have no idea. Right now, schools are basically hiring teachers away from other schools. House Bill 3058 does not solve the shortage. It empowers a bridge that could help thousands of students with the opportunity to take a CTE class. We do need long-term answers, such as those proposed in House Bill 2624, sponsored by Representative Reardon. Establishing teacher training programs in CTE will take time to implement. House Bill 3058 empowers a bridge by adding retired CTE teachers to the PERS 1039-hour exception list. The bill is written with a June 30th, 2018 sunset. The revenue impact is zero. Hiring a PERS retired CTE teacher actually costs the districts less money because they do not have to make the PERS contribution for that teacher. Part of the scary thing, though, for a retired CTE teacher is that if they exceed the 1039 hours, they have to pay back all of their PERS earnings and re-retire. It's a very complex and onerous process.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat that last sentence?
Yes. If you are retired under PERS and you exceed that 1039, 1040 hour limit, you have to pay back everything that you've taken out. Then you have to go through a re-retirement process. There's a gal at PERS that runs this, and in a meeting I talked about, it's like 200 people in Oregon about 3 years ago that were in this mess. And so this is a really scary thing. As a tax accountant, I work with people on some of these issues. House Bill 3058 would take that danger off the table. So right now, if a school district, if a principal wants to hire someone, 1039 gives them about 0.5 time, which means if they wanted to reopen a program or continue a program, they can't get a full-time teacher, and a lot of times they'll need like 0.7, 0.8. Well, they can't do that. So then you got to get two part-time. It's really hard to come up with these folks. So. And we're open for questions.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say that 1039 the hours were, but that's just for public service only.
That's for working for a PERS employer.
Right.
Right.
So it has nothing to do with the private sector.
Nope. Retired person can work sure. for retired sector.
So I can say, I don't know how we can prohibit anyone from working in the private sector all they wanted.
Right. The problem the problem on the shortage is the public schools are the main ones that are providing the education to the kids. What do we have, 565,000 students in the state of Oregon?
Other question, Representative Doherty.
Well, this is more of a comment than a question. And the thing with bringing the retired teachers in, I've known these gentlemen for quite a few years. And if you went into their labs, their classrooms, and saw what was going on, you guys would be blown away. If you go into Mr. Dome's class at Hillsborough High School, he has got 8 3D printers. He has got machinery and robotics things that no other district has, in fact, and the district probably did not pay for them. They were donated and fundraised. But, I mean, different projects for kids, things like I was blown away because they had a little shed out in the back, and actually what it was is the kids had designed a solar-powered water pump to be used in third world countries. And these were high school kids that had gone through and done that. And the same thing with Mr. Smith's robotics, all of these at Sherwood High School, where they had a program for girls only in engineering and so on. So there's just, I don't think a lot of you realize some of the tremendous, tremendous programs that are going on in high schools. But unfortunately, they're retiring. And they no longer have training programs like these gentlemen went through. So very, very important issue. And especially with the retirement, you teach 1,040 hours, and you're actually your PERS is recalculated at the rate that you were being paid at as a retired person. So it's I had a tutor in Salem that worked too many hours, and her retirement after 36 years in teaching was recalculated on her tutor wages, and it was horrible.
Senator Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, because the reason we're in the situation is we had issues with teachers that were basically retiring then coming in and working again. Is it that difficult to find people out of the private sector with unemployment rates the way they are and with layoffs that have happened across the state?
I want to speak to that.
Because, well, this is a question to you, so you get to speak to it and everything, because this is something the committee needs to understand, because there's more to it, because we have a lot of young teachers that are graduating that can't find work and things to do. So I would like to focus more on that, because that's the issue, that's what this bill's about. So, because we need to understand that here.
So, for example, last spring I had a gentleman from industry who came in and spent several days in class with me in hopes of going into teaching in the engineering CTE area. And so I didn't show him the salary schedule. But after several days, I finally decided I'm going to have to show him the salary schedule. When I pulled up the salary schedule and explained you're going to start at about $42,000 a year, his immediate comment was, I'm making $75,000 where I'm at. Yeah. And so we have not been able to get the folks to come back in from industry. I wish we could. I wish I could tell you that we have this great pathway and that people are coming back in from industry, but it's just not happening.
It is an option, and it's one of the efforts that can be made, and one part of the solution. But we're needing hundreds, and the salary differential in the engineering and computer science, it's even worse salary differential for coming back into teaching, because they would start basically on the inexperienced point. There may be some flexibility based on a contract, but it is a pathway, and it will happen and is happening, but it's a small percentage of what is needed.
So we had a Kinnemer, question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple, if you indulge me. Try to get through them. I guess a couple of things. One is it's sort of interesting to me. I guess my experience with technical education dates back to the previous century when my children were in school. And I guess from what I'm hearing, it was a remarkably different education. because as I recall, there was nothing regarding high tech available at the Saban Center back in the early 90s. So this is a little different situation, and so I appreciate your explaining some of this. I guess a couple of things that I'm wondering about. This bill would encourage those who are currently in to probably take early retirement and then double dip. Is that, and I appreciate the sunset being in there. At least that solves some of the problem, and I'd like you to speak to that.
So that could potentially happen. One of the benefits of that happening, mm-hmm. if that does happen, is once the person goes ahead and retires, that caps the PERS payments from the school district into their retirement. So that would actually
be financially. That's a lifelong decision.
Yeah, it would be financially advantageous to the school district to do that.
In addition to that, generally the salaries are negotiated a little bit lower. That so Don and I, or I'm currently teaching, Don is retired, but I'm at the top of the salary schedule and have been for some time. But if I were to, you know, select this option for the future, I would have to negotiate with the district, and it would, for the most part, the experience has been the salaries are mid-salary range versus at the top of the salary, and therefore the district saves money when that's the case.
So, and to add to that, part of what's really advantageous for a school district is trying to figure out who you're going to hire next, because these positions are so hard to fill. So if the person retires and you hire them back, then you know for sure that they've retired, and you can work on getting a second person, the next person identified, and potentially have some crossover, rather than getting a retirement announcement at the end of the school year and then having a very short time frame to try to retread and make sure that the transfer is occurring. So there's actually some financial benefits to it, as well as planning and organization benefits. Now, of course, the teacher has to agree to come back. Mm-hmm. The administrators at the school district have to desire to have a teacher come back. There's a whole combination of automatic checks and balances on this thing. For the most part, as an administrator or as someone working with people in the field, we want to have it takes about 5 years to build a program. It takes about 10,000 hours, 5 years, most of us feel, to develop a profession. And so you would use, my perception is this thing would be used as a bridge, but not as a long-term solution. Besides, most people are 58 to 60-something when they do retire, and there's a limit to how long they really want to work.
Did you have another question?
One more, if I could. Thank you. Now, when people graduate one of these programs from high school, are they likely to go directly into employment, or are they likely to seek further education before they move into high-tech fields?
Well, the hope is that schools that have a rich CTE program are creating work-ready and college-ready diplomas. So the answer to your question is yes and either.
With the number of students that we have, I know in our teaching we've seen students who absolutely want to go to college and for some reason financial, immigration, whatever, can't necessarily get in right away. Essentially, part of our challenge in the school system is to try to prepare that whole range of students. Some students will go into some work immediately. Some students will go into community college. Some will go into technical training or technical training schools or military. Some will go on to college. As CTE teachers, especially because we have industry experience and we've been out and we've interacted with some of those folks, it makes us better able to work with the range of those students. Plus, a lot of students are very tactile kinesthetic. They're kind of hands-on oriented, and especially developmentally at that age. Those kinds of programs I've seen those programs be the program that keeps a kid in school. Mm-hmm. And the relationship with those teachers, if the teachers have been out in business and industry quite a bit, in my case, I had hundreds of hours of adult volunteers that came in and worked with me. And I really believe that kids are starved for adult interaction.
Representative Esquivel, you have another question?
I have a first question.
Second question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this definition of education service district as a career in tech education, technical education instructor, could that in any way be construed to go into different facets of the district? Because my concern would be, unless we nail this down to a specificity on exactly what it is, I don't want to see this being mutated out into something completely different, where we're just like Representative Widener was talking about, the young teachers that are coming out of school and they have to pay they have to pay retirement and all this stuff, whereas this individual doesn't. Would we be doing two things? One is, would we be getting people to retire and come back and work and getting a pay raise? Or would we also be cutting off people that come into the system? Because I don't want this to go out past a specific target. I guess that's my concern.
Well, CTE is a defined endorsement. Career Technical Education through TSPC is a specific endorsement that's for teaching a specific field. I don't know if that answered the question completely.
Representative Doherty?
If I could answer, you cannot teach unless you are endorsed in a certain subject area. So in other words, if you were not endorsed in CTE, you can't go in and teach CTE until you get that endorsement. Because if you have unlicensed teachers and unendorsed teachers, you can lose your school funding.
Well, I understand that, but what I don't want to do is have this thing mutated out and got strings sticking out here.
Well, I'm not quite sure this bill deals with that. That's a TSPC issue, but yeah.
Because I would have a concern on that part of it. As long as it's buttoned up, I don't have a real heartburn on it.
So we've talked with TSPC some, and in the rules, we believe that in the rules they can address those issues. So essentially, to be a CTE teacher, you've got to have a license from TSPC, and then there's an endorsement that adds to your license, much like on your driver's license. You may have, in the old driver's license, we had additional endorsements. So we definitely want people to come into this field. The problem is we don't have enough people coming into the field to meet the current need.
And that's what this bill is more specifically about instead of all these other outside issues that seem to be popping up.
We don't want to lose programs because they can't find a teacher.
Right. Understand. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony this morning. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3058 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3137. Jan, could you give us a quick description, please?
Well, this is a measure that creates an unlawful employment practice of requiring employees to create, to file, or sign a document that contains false information related to the hours or pay that they receive, or to retaliate against an employee for refusing to do so. It allows a private right of action for an alleged violation. There are two amendments before you from the sponsor of the bill. One is just a very technical. It talks about instead of forcing a person, you are inducing the person to sign the document. The proposed two amendment clarifies that the employee may bring a civil action or file a complaint with BOLI.
Thank you. I'd like to bring up Representative Nathanson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Oregon laws promise that most workers who work more than 40 hours a week are entitled to overtime pay. However, the ability of the state to make good on that promise to some of its workers has been hindered by a deceptive employment practice where workers are coerced into signing falsified time cards, and therefore they are denied their hard-earned pay. Though the economy is improving, we're all aware that workers continue to face steep economic challenges. Many businesses are understandably doing what they can to keep costs down and business running. This often means that they're trying to do more with fewer employees. As a result, the workload for many workers is higher, and sometimes it may involve working additional hours to finish projects or to complete assignments or even just in the normal course of business. Some employers have taken advantage of the situation to get more work out of employees without paying them for overtime. A situation such as this was recently brought to my attention. An employee had worked many overtime hours for their employer over the course of the pay period, and this happened in more than one pay period. When they went to fill out their time card, however, the employer required it to be written in such a way that the employee was not going to be paid overtime. The time card was filled out at the place of business, and the employee was not given a copy of it. The same was required of other employees, too, who worked there. Oregon has wage theft laws that are normally meant to provide workers the protection in these types of situations. However, in this particular case, the employee was not given a copy of the time card, so the employee lacked the documentation to prove what might be popularly known as wage theft. So the employees were forced to sign these falsified time cards. They may be left with no remedy when they are denied the overtime. They lacked the good evidence to show the discrepancy between the hours they worked and how they were paid. Workers subjected to this kind of practice are working long hours to support their family. They're exploited as they struggle to make ends meet. The employee experiences the direct harm of this practice. But there's an indirect adverse impact as well. Responsible business owners that pay their workers fair wages and do pay overtime face unfair competition from businesses employing the practice of falsifying time cards. House Bill 3137 is drafted to solve this one narrow problem. The bill makes it an unlawful employment practice to induce an employee to sign documents containing false information related to hours worked or compensation received. And as you've heard described, you have two amendments. They're really housekeeping amendments, tweaking the wording to make it more clear. This bill will ensure that Oregon's workers are paid the compensation they deserve, and it will promote fair and equitable economic growth among employers. I want to thank BOLI and the Northwest Workers Justice Project for their assistance in understanding this issue and helping me craft a solution. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Is questions? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this not against the law now?
Yeah.
I mean, granted, it was a long time ago when I worked in the wood products, but we, you know, that was very illegal back in the latter 60s, early 70s, for sure. Has that changed or something? Because all they had to do is take a calendar or a book, keep track of their time, and it would hold up against the employer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel, it has been against the law. It's been hard to enforce. This bill is meant to address the narrow problem of not providing a copy of the time card. Even though it was a requirement, it's been hard to prove, and I hope that the speakers who are signed up to testify after me can help explain why this bill helps enforce a law that we thought we could enforce and will help us actually indeed enforce it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Let you get back to, you know, your exciting world of budgets.
Next door,
and,
yes.
And
thank
you. we'll call up the next testifiers.
Thank you.
So I'd like to have Bonnie Allen Saylor. Hope I said that right. Art, I can never remember your name. Arthur Towers and Paloma Sparks. Good morning. If somebody would introduce themselves and begin their testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm just here to testify in support of House Bill 3137. Representative Nathanson came to us a while ago with some concerns that she had discovered that this was a problem that was occurring. There are various laws on the books right now requiring employers to pay overtime and requiring them to give payroll documents and not to deduct. But there's a little bit of a hole where an employee is being forced to falsify documents, and this is an attempt to close that hole. And that is my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead and listen to the rest of the testimony first.
For the record, my name is Bonnie Allen Saylor. I'm a staff attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this. We think this bill is an important step, as Paloma said, to kind of fill a hole and strengthen the law to ensure that workers are actually paid for all of the hours they work. The Northwest Workers Justice Project, for those of you who are unfamiliar, provides legal support and advocacy to workers and their organizations, focusing on low-wage workers, those most marginalized by the current structure of our economy. We really see House Bill 3137 as a simple common-sense measure. It prohibits employers from pressuring or forcing their workers to create or sign time cards that do not reflect the actual hours worked. And also, importantly, and I think this gets a little bit to Representative Esquivel's question, it also prohibits employers from retaliating against workers who object to that practice. So yes, there are ways for a worker who has documented his hours to try and push back and claim the money he's owed, but this kind of broader retaliation prohibition would also protect those who might speak up on behalf of the workers in general. You know, we see sometimes a low-level manager who's pushing back, who's been asked by superiors to shave time and is pushing back against that, then get fired. And so this retaliation protection would, we think, make it more likely that the entire workplace would be run in a fair manner and pay all of their workers for the time they worked. So in addition to overtime, this also comes up a lot in terms of breaks. Workers are often clocked out, sometimes automatically by the payroll software, for breaks that they don't actually get to take and are then forced to sign off on those time cards as if they took those breaks. I think that about covers. I have some additional comments and written testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, on the record and off the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I appreciate the chance to testify today. A few weeks ago, you heard from a number of our members who fight for injured workers. We also have a number of members who fight for workers who are discriminated against on the job for over age, gender, family situation, race, disability, and the like. Our members in this area fight for whistleblowers, fight against wrongful termination and wage theft. I just wanted to add our voice today. We, our members have identified this as a gap, not a, a huge gap, but an important gap to fill in the law. And we just wanted to be on record in support of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hurd.
So you referenced this hole several times. I'm an employer. I've never, ever heard of a situation where it's legal to manipulate or force my employees to falsify time documents. And I question how you're going to actually lord over people effectively enough to where you can, because I'm just saying, for an employer who's determined to short their employees overtime, I still don't see how this changes it. Because if they're engaging their employees in such a manner, they're going to be managing them when they're filling out their time card anyway. So when they get the copy's already been manipulated. And I'm just curious as to where you can point to this hole that makes it legal to do illegal things. I don't get it.
Chair Hulvey, Representative Hurd, it is not explicitly illegal in current statute.
Follow up.
So if an employee complained against an employer and somehow you proved this, under current law, there wouldn't be fines issued?
Chair Hulvey, Representative Hurd, if I can add on, I think that, you know, it certainly is illegal to not pay workers for the hours they worked, but there's not a law that specifically targets the manipulation of the time records to do that, which creates a real possibility for, you know, that proof, the time records of the hours worked, to be manipulated. And while, yes, they're, you know, workers would be able to, if they were able to collect their own proof somehow, they might be able to push back and get the money they're owed for that time period. The employer would not, under current law, face additional penalties for having manipulated or coerced the workers to sign that. And we really see that, especially in terms of the hole it fills, as being around that retaliation piece, which we think, you know, protects whistleblowers and workers. Right now, it's not necessarily squarely protected for a worker to speak up against the practice.
Final. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm very sympathetic to the objective of this bill. I think we all are. Obviously, no one would condone retaliation for refusing to engage in wage and hour violations. However, I do have some questions. although it is not explicitly illegal, this particular this practice is not defined in statute. Isn't there currently, under both state and federal law, prohibitions against retaliating against an employee for engaging in illegal activity? It's a general, broader one, even though this isn't explicitly mentioned. So, A, isn't this covered by that? B, if it's not covered by that, wouldn't it still be covered by wrongful discharge, which is the interstitial thing, i.e., when things aren't explicitly mentioned, they're sometimes actionable under wrongful discharge? And the reason I ask those two things is because the wrongful discharge jurisprudence in the state of Oregon between the federal and state courts, my understanding of it is that it's strained. And the Court of Appeals is going to assume that we're doing this quite purposefully in that context. And I'm concerned that, by good intentions, we're going to send a signal that actually makes the law worse in some ways to the Court of Appeals. That's my concern. So I guess two questions. Isn't this already illegal, even if it's not explicit? B, even if it's not, isn't it covered by the wrongful discharge? And C, do we need to worry about the state of wrongful discharge law in Oregon and how this bill might affect that? Sorry to drop that on you, though. No notice. I am.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton. I'm not an attorney. I won't spar with you on the law, but I will say a couple things.
Please.
One is that, again, as our members reviewed the variety of bills before this committee, they did identify this one as a place with a gap. The second thing I would say is that, really to Representative Hurd's question about kind of the low-road employers who engage in this sort of activity, having another tool in the toolbox to tackle those folks, is a good thing, not a bad thing. And the third thing I'd say is that the federal remedies for this oftentimes pose another set of problems for vulnerable workers. And so, again, I hear the concerns mm-hmm. about the duplication, the potential for duplication. But again, my sense of things is that this plugs a small but important gap. Again, when we're talking about the handful but meaningful number of outrageous employers.
Representative Doherty.
Part of it was more a comment than a question, but it's to bring up to answer some of these things, especially with the idea of, well, they can file a wrongful discharge suit. I've been fired once in my life when I was in college, and it was over this exact same thing of time cards, because that was back in the days before they had punch things and they would do that. And I had somebody, a boss, go through and illegally change my time card. And so when I questioned him, I was fired on the spot.
Wow.
And first of all, as a college student, had nothing idea about this. And I was an activist, so I would have gone after, anybody almost. But when you're working two jobs and going to school full-time and having to go out and get a third job so you can go to school full-time, this is not something that a lot of people will go through and try to file or even have the wherewithal to go through and say, well, this was wrong, and so I'm going to file a wrongful, discharge claim. And so I think what it is it's just it's sending a very, very clear message, because this has been going on for decades, decades and decades. So I think what it is it's, again, it's one other tool, because they're still doing it.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, because I've always thought this was a law myself and everything else, but I'm sitting here thinking about all the different employers that we have out there that pay differently. You have some places that pay straight commission because they're a sales organization. Some places where you have people that are on salary and they get X dollars a month, and this is the job that you have to do each week. So you could be there 60 hours, you could be there 30 hours, and it varies from week to week. So I'm just wondering how that's going to affect those situations and those employers that have those instances set up, because all of a sudden the person might be disgruntled because something went wrong and they had to be there an extra 10 hours, but they're a salaried employee, and now they can file a game or a complaint against the employer when it might have been a mistake that they made. So,
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, this bill doesn't change anything about people's rights to get paid. So if it's someone who is correctly being paid salary in a non-exempt position where they're not entitled to overtime, this bill would not affect their ability to get, you know, it doesn't affect their rights to get paid differently for that.
Commissioned employees, say sales are down. I mean, I have two sons that are straight commission.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, this also wouldn't affect commissioned employees. I do believe that under federal law, and now I'm not 100% sure and I can confirm if this is true, but I do believe that in any case an employer is supposed to be tracking the hours a worker works, even if they're getting paid by commission to... No, I'm doubting that. But it certainly wouldn't change their right to get paid under the commission scheme.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, my daughter is in the situation, or one of the situations you described, a manager, assistant manager, let's not glorify this, assistant manager at a restaurant. And she's in a managerial position, and she's expected to work 50 hours, and 50 morphs into 70 more weeks than her daughters would care that to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but this is bill, in my opinion, doesn't necessarily address that.
Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really a comment for purposes of legislative history. In the event that no matter what happens with this bill, I hope it is clear from this discussion that I think that the purpose of our considering this bill, we're not attempting to denigrate in any way minimize otherwise existing rights that currently exist under wrongful discharge or other laws. This is one of those things where the legislature might attempt to clarify something and make something more explicit. But that's not to say that it doesn't exist now or that we're attempting to acknowledge any limitations in current wrongful discharge law. We're just trying to make something clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was just wondering how this gives any more teeth to enforcement. I mean, I think we're all in agreement with that this is bad and we're sympathetic to this, but I'm just wondering how this makes it any more enforceable.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, it would just create another... that this would just be something that we would be able to investigate. I assume that it would come when an employee filed a complaint for that they were due overtime and that their employer had shorted them. It would just be another part of that claim.
And I would add that we see a lot of value in explicit protections, like Representative Doherty referred to, you know, without at all dismissing the real important role that wrongful discharge plays in our law. Oftentimes where there's an explicit retaliation protection, that gives employees the ability to enforce their rights more independently. You know, it may actually reduce, you know, to bring a wrongful discharge suit, you're going to have to get a lawyer involved. But to go to your employer and say, you know, I asked you about, you know, not cutting these hours off my time cards, and now all of a sudden, like, you're not giving me any work. I think that's illegal under the law, you know, and having a really clear law to point to can also improve enforcement.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Up next, I'd like to have Betsy Earls. Good morning. If we'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I am appearing before you today to discuss House Bill 3137.
Ooh, she's trying to get me.
Okay. I know something. The kinder, gentler AOI. Because we're going to fall asleep. So.
Sorry.
So let me just be clear again that we don't oppose, we don't oppose the idea of requiring an employer to provide a copy of a signed time card, which is Representative Nathan's stated intent with House Bill 3137 to employees. But 3137 appears to go further than that by placing penalties for falsifying time card records in Oregon discrimination statutes. It's already against the law, has been pointed out here this morning, under ORS 652, the wage and hour statutes, for an employer to avoid paying all the wages that are owed. And the discrimination statutes already provide a remedy for employees who protest under the whistleblower statutes, specifically 659A-199. So with all that said, we have talked quite a bit in this committee and in this building this session about wage theft. There are several bills addressing the problem around the building from different angles, and I believe that there's an effort afoot to gather a work group to discuss the broader issue of wage theft and try and find some more specific solutions this session to deal with the problem. I'm hoping that AOI will be included in that effort, and we're looking forward to working with Representative Nathanson and others on the issue.
Thank you. Question? Boy, not seeing any questions for you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Don't see anyone else signed up for House Bill 3137. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3137. And the committee will stand at ease. Bring the committee back into order, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2798.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure you heard late February. It modifies the percentage rate and the amount of fees that a pawnbroker may charge for storage and setup in connection with a pledge loan. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact, nor is there a fiscal impact.
That's why she's here.
Representative Barton.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
There's a question as to whether it was really a work session you opened or a public hearing. Do you want to just...
I thought I opened a work session.
I'm not sure which it was, and I just thought we...
You need to pay attention. I said work session.
No. Well, that's true, I do, but, and
but
I apologize.
Just in case
you were wrong, sir.
Just in case you were wrong, I'll reopen a work session or open a work session if I hadn't already on House Bill 2798.
Would you like a motion again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I renew the motion or state it again. Or state it again. Or make for the first time, depending on how House Bill 2798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Other discussion? I'll just comment that I did have a question for DCBS that I think has been addressed, but I didn't really hear back from them, and I'm comfortable moving the bill on and that they have had that discussion. We'll confirm that later on, but I'm still comfortable moving the bill. So no other discussion. Matthew, can we have a vote count?
Representative Brenna?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative West?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kimber?
Aye.
Chair Holdy?
Aye. House Bill 2798, having received the votes, has passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2798.
Are you
going to
sign a carrier?
Representative Doherty, do you want to carry this bill? Or?
Sure. Yes, sir.
With enthusiasm, Representative Doherty will carry the bill. With that, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2386. And Jan, I think it's appropriate that you describe the amendments that are before us today before we take a motion.
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. This is the measure that authorizes the Labor Commissioner to issue a temporary cease and desist order when there's a reason to believe that any statutes governing the prevailing wage rate, farm and construction labor contractors, wage and hour, and employment conditions have been violated. So on OLIS, there are a number of amendments. The proposed dash 3 amendment would require the commissioner to pay reasonable attorney fees if the defendant prevails. Proposed dash 4 amendment specifies that the commissioner's reason to believe may be based on factors but are not limited to the previous violations, the receipt of more than one complaint, a complaint being filed with another agency on a relevant issue, or information from the interagency compliance network. The proposed dash 5 amendment authorizes the labor commissioner to impose a civil penalty when an employer fails to pay wages on the regular payday, as long as there's a failure is not due to circumstances beyond that employer's control. And it authorizes the labor commissioner to administratively compel the employer to provide a bond when the employer fails to establish and maintain a regular payday. The proposed 6th amendment requires the commissioner to pay damages related to the enforcement of a temporary cease and desist order if the defendant prevails in a contested case hearing or upon appeal. And the damages are to include but not be limited to actual damages, reasonable attorney fees, and back pay to the defendant's employees. The proposed 7th amendment requires the commissioner to pay reasonable attorney fees up to $50,000 if the defendant prevails. And finally, the dash 8 amendment prohibits a temporary cease and desist order that would include production of perishable agricultural products.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Barton.
Just so you know, it's my intention to move the dash 4 and dash 5 amendments with your permission. And having said that, I'd like to move to adopt the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2386.
Representative Barton moves the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2386. Discussion. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we have those reread, the dash 4? I think that had to do with reasonable.
The dash 4, it specifies that the commissioner's reason to believe when they're going to issue a temporary cease and desist order can be based on these factors, but they're not limited to these factors. And it's that there be a previous violation, that there's a receipt of more than one complaint, that a complaint has been filed with another agency on a relevant issue, or that there's information provided from the interagency compliance network.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For me, it's my intention to move the dash 6 amendments, because that seems to be the fairest. The dash 4s, I'll be a no on. Dash 5s, I will be a no on as well. The dash 6s are the amendment that I think kind of achieves and helps out all parties in play at this at one time. The dash 6s address a lot of the issues from letting the bully just file a suit or go in and place a cease and desist on somebody too quickly. They need to know that there is a problem, that they are guilty. If he wants to circumvent the due process, or he or she, whoever is in charge of bully, wants to circumvent due process, they will be able to.
Yeah, you can speak be able to that amendment when make a motion.
So, but the dash 4s, I am a no on and will be a no on the dash 4s that are up right now.
Thank you. Other discussion? Solely about the dash 4, right? This is the dash 4. Represent Matthew, would you give us a roll call vote?
Representative Brett?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Eskimo?
No.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative
Byrd?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kinnebrew?
No.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Dash 4 amendment, having received the votes, is adopted to House Bill 2386.
Chair Holby, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2386.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2386. Discussion.
Yeah,
one more time from Jan what that is?
Yes. Go ahead and give us again. There are a lot of amendments here, so let's keep them straight.
That's right. The dash five, it authorizes the commissioner to impose a civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 when the employer fails to pay wages on the regular payday as long as the failure is not due to circumstances beyond the employer's control. And as well, it authorizes a commissioner to administratively compel the employer to provide a bond when that employer fails to establish and maintain a regular payday.
Thank you.
And I will add, dash five has no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact, and the statement is been posted on OLIS.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Seeing that none, Matthew?
Representative Greta?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Leibner?
No.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
No.
Chair Holder?
Aye. That's Bill 28, or... The dash five amendment to House Bill 2386, having received votes, is passed, adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
I move the dash six amendments to House Bill 2386.
Representative Widener moves the dash six amendment to House Bill 2386. Discussion?
Jan.
Can we reread it?
Ken, Jan, can you read it again?
This is the amendment that requires the commissioner to pay damages related to the enforcement of a temporary cease and desist order if the defendant prevails in a contested case or upon appeal. The damages include but are not limited to actual damages, reasonable attorney fees, and back pay to defendant's employees.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener, speak to the dash six again.
Basically, what we want, just in case a labor commissioner goes in and issues a cease and desist, this would allow him, the defendant, if they prevail and were shut down falsely, to basically be compensated for any lost revenue that they incurred from the shutdown. It could be, say, I'm agricultural, have blueberries, I have 3 days to get them off of the field. I get shut down because I didn't pay on time. My crop goes bad. I could have lost millions of dollars sitting there because I didn't get them off the field in time. It could be a paper mill where it's $10,000 an hour of lost production that are shut down. Lots of other employees have lost their wages over this time because there were three employees that might have complained and were shut down. So this way, it has to be something egregious for Bully to go in and say, you know what, we're going to issue a cease and desist and put this plant down. That's why I have the dash six amendments, because it needs to be only to happen in very, very egregious cases. If the labor commissioner does not know that they will prevail, then they need to go through the due process and use the court system for hashing this out with an employer, because the way I see the bill right now, basically they're guilty and they have to prove innocence, and that's what's happening. We're not having to prove guilt. The labor commissioner will come in and say, you're guilty, we're shutting you down, you're issuing a cease and desist. There's no due process for the employer with the way the bill is stated right now, and the dash six is kind of brings some balance to that.
Other discussion, Representative Evans.
Yeah, I'm sensitive to the concerns raised in the dash six discussion. I actually supported an amendment, the dash seven, to be drafted. I understand that neither of those were included in the final negotiation. So the bottom line is, I'm going to support the dash four, dash five changes as a courtesy vote. I'm not going to stand in the way or try to push the amendment I put forward today, but I do hope we have more time to talk about the concerns, and I think legitimate concerns, about a new tool in the toolkit for Bowley to make sure that we watch it carefully so that there is no overreach.
Ms. Sparks, would you care to come up and address the concerns about the closure of businesses and watching crops disintegrate.
For the record, Paloma Sparks from the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Are you talking about a different amendment than the dash sixes, which you're on, or are we talking about that? There was a discussion, but we're the sixes are before us.
The sixes are before us, but he did address the issue of the issue of this shutting down businesses and it's and the resulting impact to crops, for example, that he brought up in his example. It's my indication from talking to the commissioner that actually is not how this cease and desist order works. So, Ms. Sparks.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that's correct. A cease and desist order would require an employer to cease the unlawful activity. It does not shut down a business. Further, in the instance of where we're talking about blueberries, a few years back, the U.S. Department of Labor came in and were pretty heavy-handed with some blueberry farmers. Commissioner Avakian actually explicitly stood up for the blueberry farmers in that instance. We do not think that threatening an employer with complete shutdown is the right way to use any sort of enforcement tools. Where we would use this is where we've got a real case. We can identify who's been injured, and we have concerns that additional employees are going to be injured or that the harm is going to continue. This is not intended as a tool to shut down businesses, and that is also in the bill. It says that you will cease and desist the unlawful activity.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paloma, when we had testimony on this, that power already exists with Bully, and it's not even Commissioner Avakian, because he'll be here for 4 years, 8 years, and he's down the road, and it's somebody new coming in. This is more power, I think, than any labor industry has in the nation. I mean, it's allowing you to circumvent the due process. Right now, you can do it through due process and go to the judge, but the commissioner was saying, no, I want to act quicker on these people. Was that not correct in what I heard in testimony?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, we do not have the authority right now for wage and hour violations. We have cease and desist for some civil rights violations current law. There are certain provisions where we could ask a court for an injunction, but this doesn't cover most of wage and hour law.
Thank you. Other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
I think that there may be others from the business community in the audience that would want to address a different view of the Labor Commissioner's power in terms of stopping activity instead of merely the practice.
Yeah, and I'm aware.
And I wonder if we might want to have that on the record.
I'm aware that there's a lot of differences of opinion of the law. I have the agency up here, which is, I guess, the counsel to this committee. I think they've made that case in the public hearing, if I recall, about the cease and desist of businesses. Others have a different opinion, so we have different opinions in the stakeholder arena on this, and so bringing that public hearing notion back up, I'm not sure it's really necessary at this point.
I guess, thank you. I think that makes the point that there is controversy about this interpretation by the Labor Commissioner and not agreement by some of us that is a correct interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think that's good to have on.
Thank you. Representative Widener, further discussion?
Yeah, and I think just to follow up, Paloma can comment if she wants, if you're all right with that, Mr. Chair, but the Labor Commissioner said that having to use the court system took too long and he wanted to be able to act quicker. And I think we're kind of looking at hurting employers with this without giving them due process. And this bill is taking it out of the court's hand and just putting it into basically the commissioner's hand, which I guess could be said the executioner at that point. So because he just gets to execute without anybody else's say, without having to go through a judicial system to prove his case. So that's why the dash sixes, I think, are appropriate for this bill.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment. For me, the dash six is important because it does further protect the unintended consequences of a cease and desist for employees that may be surrounding that situation. Could be two, could be three employees just on this one particular job site. I think to focus on multi-thousand person plants is probably the wrong way at looking at this. I'm looking at it more from the small business side. If the commissioner comes in, shuts down a two or three person job site because of one person's complaint and it's found to be unprovable or what have you, and the court decides that the employer's in the right, not the labor commissioner, I'm concerned that the employees, through unintended consequences, will lose wages because they're not working currently for their employer. They're on unemployment insurance or what have you. And so that's why I support the DAX 6, is I believe it will protect the employees from unintended consequences.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your
patience. I have to agree with Dallas. I mean, I've got audited by the IRS. You know, it was basically what I would call a frivolous accusation. It cost me $24,000 to defend myself. They didn't even respond after 3 years, and I had no way of recouping that cost. And I think if the government is going to come down on a business and try and enforce something that they're eventually wrong on, then I think the business should have some kind of recourse in order to recoup those costs.
Yeah, I think the IRS law is a slightly different
arena
than
entity.
What we're talking about. Other discussion?
We're on the dash sixes, right?
We're still on the dash sixes. So I will stand at ease for a few minutes. I decided to have legislative counsel come in.
Okay.
Oh, she isn't? Well, we'll see how she is on her feet.
Travel much, Greg?
I'd like to bring the committee back to order and have legislative counsel up to help us with a couple of questions. I guess the question that I'm hearing is how the cease and desist order could be used. And is it used to shut down a practice, or is it used to shut down a business? One, and also two, what is the process after a cease and desist order as far as the companies or the business that's wants to appeal it, or, you know, what's the process after the cease and desist order has been placed? What are their options?
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Charlie Cheek from Legislative Council, and sitting next to me is Gail Stevens from Council, who is recently added to our staff and who comes to us from Boley. So she would be our resource beyond belief on this issue. So Gail will address your questions for you this morning.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, with respect to your first question, my...
Introduce yourself for the record.
Gail Stevens with Legislative Council. With respect to your first question, Chair Holvey, my impression is there would have to be a violation of law. The cease and desist order is to discontinue a violation of law, which could be read broadly. But with respect to your second question and how the cease and desist order would administratively go into place with a temporary cease and desist order, that would be a fairly new power that you'd be granting with this statute. My reading of the administrative rules and the surrounding statutes is that it would not be appealable until the order became final a final order, and then it would be subject to appeal under Chapter 183 of the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay. Could you answer the first question again? I'm not sure I understood the answer.
I believe the bill grants the power to order an employer to cease and desist from violations of the law. So if there's a wage and hour law being violated, for instance, the failure to pay overtime, the law would give Bully the authority to order those wages be paid. As far as shutting down a business, I can't think of a circumstance that Bully would have the authority to shut down the operation of a business, if that's your question, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Right. So I'm hearing you say that the cease and desist order is for shutting down the violation of law, not the business operations.
That's my read of this bill.
Thank you.
And the amendment? The amendment is what addresses that, doesn't it?
What's your question?
Well, we're talking, the amendment is the part where we're discussing the cease and desist. Is that in regards to the dash 5?
Dash 6.
Dash 6.
In regards to the dash 6, I'm not sure what the question is about that question. I guess, Representative Widener, you had the question.
Yeah. Hi, Galen, you drafted this for me, and I appreciate it. The dash 6, then with the wage and hour, basically anything that happened over that period, we drafted the dash 6 so Bully would reimburse the employer. So if Bully comes in with a cease and desist, says, no, you didn't pay overtime, you didn't do all of this, and places a cease and desist, they have to pay those lost wages or whatever Bully came in for. And the dash 6 just says, you're going to have to repay the business and all their attorney fees if they prevail and you do this, correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, my read of the dash 6 amendment is that if the employer ultimately prevails, the commissioner is incorrect and the employer ultimately prevails, that any actual damages incurred by the employer, for instance, reasonable attorney fees, costs, and in this amendment, back pay to the employees, for instance, if some direct result resulted in a slowdown where employees had to be laid off, any direct result of the cease and desist order under the dash 6 amendment would be reimbursable.
Representative Hurd.
So point of clarification, so is legislative counsel saying the cease and desist order cannot stop a job site from continuing to be productive? I hear you saying stop the alleged illegal practice, but say it's a three-person job site. The commissioner, through this law, you're saying cannot, and that's a question, you're saying cannot come in and stop work while the investigation goes on?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, I can't think of a set of circumstances where Bully would have the authority to shut down the business outright.
Are you done?
Follow up, sir.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not what I was saying. I didn't say shut down the business. I said shut down a job site. It could be one employee, two employees. Can, through this law, the labor commissioner come in and potentially stop work while the investigation happens? So it could be something related to danger for the employee. It may not be wage related directly.
Chair Holby, Representative Hurd, that sounds more like a sort of an OSHA, a safety violation that you're talking about, and less like something under Bully's jurisdiction. If I'm understanding the scenario that you present correctly, I can't see Bully shutting down a business based on a safety violation. They do investigate retaliation for reporting OSHA violations, but that's very different from the underlying safety violations themselves.
But regardless of
follow up, sir.
Regardless of why he or she, whoever the commissioner is or their deputies, is investigating or issuing the cease and desist, I just need to know, can they stop progress on the job site? Say, until this is settled, no more work.
Representative Holvey.
Yeah.
Charlie Cheek again from council. Representative Hurd, I think what you're describing, and I think I understand it, is a multi-employer job site, mm-hmm. construction site, something like that. And one of the employers is engaged in this practice and has received, there's this cease and desist order against them. It would seem to me that the answer to your question is, what is it that's being halted? If the practice of is halting one of the three contractors that's working on the site or whatever, and they can no longer perform, that could halt the job project because they simply can't fulfill their responsibilities to keep the timeline for the project on course. But I agree with what Gail said, that the Boley does not have the authority to just come in and padlock the business itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So to follow up on Representative Hurd's issue is once a cease and desist order is levied for an unlawful practice, or what happens if the employer or doesn't change that practice? What's the consequence to ignoring the cease and desist order?
Chair Holby, my impression is that would depend on the specifics of the cease and desist order and the unlawful practice that were being stopped. Do you have a specific example in mind?
Say the employer was paying in cash instead of, this is one that comes to mind, paying in cash instead of having a legitimate payroll according to law.
Chair,
and they, the next week they paid in cash again and then paid in cash again.
Chair Holvey, my understanding is they would be able to order the employer to cease and desist from paying in cash and follow the laws that regulate payroll distribution, proper payroll distribution, and that until that became a final order and were subject to appeal, that cease and desist order would remain in effect.
And it is a legal order,
right.
So there is a process by which you can't simply ignore a legal order. You have to comply with it, or I would assume that it would be turned over to the district attorney to actually close the business down for continually violating a cease and desist order.
Right. So that's a different.
Yeah, different.
Okay. Representative Kinnemer, question?
I did, but given the time, I think I will cease and desist.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thank
you. Veteran legislator right there.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I guess I was getting a little dilatory myself. Representative Barreto, do you have one more question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. Is it possible then to amend this language here to where the cease and desist is specifically designating that offense rather than just a general cease and desist as it's listed here? It says the final order issued under this section, a cease and desist order against an employer.
For you to amend that, you would have to have an amendment ready to move at this point.
I understand that. So that's why I'm asking this question, because I don't have one. It's not here. So this bill would go forward as is written, and mm-hmm. that's a struggle. And then also, if I could question line 32 and 33, the final order may also be enforced by a writ of mandamus or civil action to compel performance. Could you explain that?
Go ahead.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto.
Page 3, line
32,
33. I do see. It would be an order similar to an injunctive order from a court ordering the employer to ultimately act with respect to your final question on those lines. With respect to your first question on the unlawful practice and the way that's phrased, that could potentially be narrowed, but it's any unlawful practice.
Okay. Thank you.
The mandamus order simply means that it orders them to do that. You have to comply with it.
Thank you.
I want to make one other point, if I could.
Certainly.
Chair Holvey. We need to keep in mind that the new language that we're putting into the bill calls out that it has to be an unlawful practice. And that is a very specific term that is used in our employment laws to get jurisdiction and to commissioner to do certain things. So if the violation is not deemed an unlawful practice, it's not going to be subject to this.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming down in your busy time and trying to clarify this for us. It was really important, I think, for us all to hear from you, and really important for us also for you to go back to work. So,
thank you for everything you guys do.
Oh, I didn't realize I was on a break.
Oh, oh, God.
This is a union shop.
We're on the dash sixes. Called question.
Yeah, we're on the dash sixes. Matthew, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Moretto?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
No.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Nope.
Fagan?
Yes. No. Excuse me. Sorry, no.
Yes, we'll take fine. The first answer.
Nope.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Nuss?
No.
Representative
Weiner?
Yes.
Representative
Barton?
No.
Representative
Hurd? Yes. Representative Weiner? Yes. The dash six not having received the votes is failed. Representative Kinnamer. You wanted to move the dash seven?
Yes, please. So, Mr. Chair, move the dash seven amendment.
Representative Kinnamer moves the dash seven amendment to House Bill 2386.
Call question, if I may.
Can Jan read it, please?
Oh, yeah. Which
one is it? A reminder that dash seven requires the commissioner to pay reasonable attorney fees up to $50,000 if the defendant prevails in the contested case hearing or upon appeal of the final order.
Jan, wasn't that the dash three or the dash one as well? Can you?
The dash three did not have a cap. The dash seven caps it at $50,000.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew?
Representative Barretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
No.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
No.
Representative Fagan?
No.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nuss?
No.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Nope.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Aye.
No. The dash seven amendments not having received the required votes has failed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
If you're ready and the time is right, I'm happy to move it to the floor. Would you like that motion?
Please.
Chair Holvey. Sorry.
Did we get the...
We didn't get the dash.
Fiscal.
Did you get the five?
No, that's a question for you. I thought
we. I believe we've adopted dash four and five.
Four and five.
Four and five.
Seven and five.
That's my recollection.
Four and fives are adopted.
Four and five. Yeah.
Are we all in agreement?
Yeah.
Yeah, four and five. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's quite all right.
This is better to be over cautious.
Quite all right.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2386 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2386 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Barretto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, on the fiscal impact of this proposed legislation, it says that in 2014, there were only 12 cases that could be subject to this provision. And these cases would take 5 to 15 hours to investigate. Based on this bill, it would take $6,500 and $8,000 per hearing. And yet I look at this bill, 12 cases in all of Oregon in 2014, and we're putting a bill here together to give the Labor Commissioner basically the ability to where the proof of burden is on the employer instead of the commission himself to find them guilty, I guess. And I look at due process being challenged. I just wonder if this bill is even constitutional. And when I look at how it is going to affect job sites, I think it's a bad bill all the way around. For the state of Oregon, I think the way it has been working so far should not be an issue, and I feel like it just gives a lot of overreach to the Bureau of Labor.
Thank you. Other discussion? Just want to reiterate, Representative Evans.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Just want to reiterate, I'm looking forward to the debate on the floor on this one. I'm going to be a yes for the bill as amended, but I still believe there was ample room to improve it. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
I'd just like to reiterate real quick. If there's, 5 to 15 hours is all they're going to investigate before they go in and issue a cease and desist, that's not very much time. So I just want to put that on the record. That definitely makes me a stronger no than I was before just hearing that.
Other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can you call the roll?
Representative
Brett? No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Basketball?
No.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Nagin?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
No.
Aye. Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kennedy?
Bring your check.
No.
Vice Chair Hovey?
Aye. House Bill 2386 is passed to the floor.
Mr. Chair, if I may just notice a possible minority report.
So noted.
I would second that.
It's out of order. With that, we have a volunteer to carry the bill.
I will, Mr.
You didn't
Chair.
Vote for it, Jim. You can't carry it.
I did vote for it.
I guess I will be the one carrying the bill.
Yes.
So, with that, I'll close the work session. House Bill 2386. Anything else, Jim? With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Actually, Rob, for your information.
Business and Labor.
Actually, Rob, for your information.
Committee on